Hope everyone's doing well. Hey, this is Robert, and welcome to The Outfall. This is a podcast where we uncover surprising stories behind our water world and everyday infrastructure. Do you hear that clinking sound? You know, that's the sound of modern convenience. Ice cubes, right? Something we all take for granted. But rewind time not too long ago, and ice was a luxury only the wealthy in the North could afford. Well, recently, I fell down a rabbit hole reading about the early ice trade and how frozen water built empires changed history. I know, it sounds about as thrilling as watching ice melt, but stick with me. Today, we're returning to the early 1800s and meeting Frederick Tudor, the visionary Bostonian who pioneered the global ice trade. Frederick shipped New England ice to the world's farthest corners, from India to the Caribbean. You know, folks called him crazy, but he called them future customers. So how did Frederick go from debt to this ice empire? In this episode, we'll hear directly from the Ice King himself about his icy vision.
Icy vision? Please, allow me to clarify. Frederick Tudor's the name. A true Bostonian, through and through. I hailed from a decent family, but my parents left me to carve my own path. In my youthful days, at the age of 22, an idea struck me like a winter's chill. Why not bring this cold luxury to the warm South? Surely they'd pay a pretty penny. Owing to my mother's acquaintances in France, I settled upon Martinique for my pioneering venture. In the frosty February of 1806, I chartered a vessel laden with 80 tons of pristine Boston ice. I encountered a snag. Most didn't have the faintest idea of preserving the purchased ice. To be forthright, business was grim. While I garnered $2,000 from sales, I found myself in a deficit of $4,000, equivalent to an astonishing $80,000 of your modern dollars.
Didn't I read where you had, let's just say, significant debts at this point in your life?
Oh, I was practically a regular at the debtor's jail, having been dragged in thrice and locked up twice. Then there was that little skirmish with England throwing wrenches in my plans. My challenges just fired up my determination.
Okay, let's just stop here. What was your lesson from this period of your life?
I realized my business was as much about storage as selling. Everyone was burying their hopes literally with ice houses in the ground. But me, I dreamt up. I conjured this idea of an above-ground ice fortress, 25 feet each way, with double walls, sawdust insulation, peat padding, and a clever little drainage system. It was more than just a storage. It was my revelation. Before I knew it, profits soared, paving the way for expansion, Charleston being my prime target.
And speaking of Charleston, I've read that even the legislature turned you down when you went and tried to get a monopoly for this ice business, but you didn't back down.
That's right. I brought in my best hands from Boston. We put up an ice house and we're ready for business.
So I found an original copy of a newspaper advertisement you posted in Charleston right when you first started. I love it. So let's listen to this gem. The ice establishment at Fitzsimmons Wharf is now open. Ice will be for sale at all hours of the day, from sunrise to sundown, except when the ice house keeper is necessarily absent at his meals. It will be sold at any quantity, from 1 pound to 500 pounds. The price will be 8 cents per pound, the best method of carrying ice in a small quantity is to wrap it in a blanket. These may be had at the ice house of sufficient size for a dollar. Of the mode of keeping ice best when it's carried home, it is observed that it should be kept as part of the house which is least cool, that is to say, in a dry closet where there is no air circulation.
Ah, that particular notice from yesteryear. Now, speaking of such matters, allow me to impart a shard of wintry sagacity, the art of subscription. When I started a subscription service in Charleston for a mere $10 monthly for a consistent supply of ice, it was an arrangement many found too favorable to decline. And to provide a modicum of context, in today's terms, one would be parting with nearly $250 each month. A fair sum, wouldn't you agree?
If you only knew how far ahead of time you were with these subscriptions, man, how many subscriptions we deal with these days. So let's kind of skip ahead a little bit. You had markets established in places like Havana, Savannah, Charleston, New Orleans. You had all this growing trade. You've built these ice houses all over these places, and you're like 40 years young. You know, people now could enjoy ice cream on a summer day, refresh their drinks, and even help alleviate fevers.
So how hard was it to really find this ice? Was it just going out in the winter, finding it, and bringing it to a ship?
Ah, the pursuit of pristine ice. New England's winter could render the ponds and rivers frozen, but securing that perfect sheet wasn't easy. While the cold winters provided plenty, not all ice was created equal. The premium blocks, clear, solid, and uncontaminated, hailed primarily from freshwater ponds across Massachusetts. As the clamor for ice swelled, the pressing need for efficiency became clear as the ice we sought. Hence, we introduced the ice plow, a veritable marvel in our trade. This contraption allowed us to etch the ice's facade, creating a grid-like pattern, simplifying its fracture into consistent chunks, and thereby enhancing our packing, transport, and preservation endeavors. Yet, it wasn't solely about the tools. Discerning the ice's ideal thickness, a precise 18 inches, became an art. Too slender, it vanished before its time. It was overly stout, and its handling turned cumbersome. Hence, we became nature's keen observers, awaiting the precise moment when the ice was just so. The culmination of our efforts saw us hew in blocks, each a colossal 100 pounds or so. It was a demanding endeavor, and this exacting trade wasn't for the faint of heart. We'd ushered these blocks ashore with metal rods and then onto horse-led wagons bound for the ice houses. Robert, there was poetry to the process, and I loved all of it.
Man, that sounds like hard work. Okay, so tell me about the competition for all this natural ice. You weren't the only cowboy in town. There were others competing for this ice. How did you handle that competition?
Indeed. The competition was rife, Mr. Robert. As soon as word spread of the lucrativeness of the ice trade, many an ambitious gentleman fancied themselves ice merchants overnight. But as I soon discovered, it wasn't merely about possessing ice. It was the caliber of the ice, the precision of its delivery, and above all, unwavering tenacity. In the early days, my competitors mainly sourced their ice from smaller ponds and lakes around Boston. And while some of these locations produced decent ice, they weren't always consistent in quality or quantity. On the other hand, I turned my attention to larger bodies of water. These locations were bigger and provided clearer and cleaner ice, which was a selling point in itself. Eventually, I even brought down ice from Maine. As for getting ice before others, let's say I had my methods. My real ace up my sleeve was relationships. I forged close ties with local farmers and landowners, sometimes leasing or outright purchasing the rights to harvest ice from particular ponds. This ensured exclusive access to the best ice sources.
Now, it's interesting because in essence, it's really just kind of you're farming for natural ice. Now, I know you got to go, but there is one thing I need to talk to you about. I came across something that genuinely boggled my mind. You shipped ice now to Calcutta, India?
Well, Robert, if I had a nickel for every raised eyebrow in that venture, I'd have, well, even more nickels. Yes, indeed, the voyage to India, a whopping 16,000 miles, give or take. And in a good season, it took a ship 4 long months from Boston to touch Calcutta's shores. But guess what? I took the gamble. Loaded up 180 tons of the best New England ice, gave that hold some extra insulation, and packed the ice tighter than folks at a Boston pub on a Friday night. Topped it off with a cozy hay blanket. Sure, 80 tons melted away, but the 100 tons that remained? Pure gold. Or could I say cold cash? And for the next 50 years, it wasn't just tea brewing in India, it was my profits from the ice trade.
And that wraps up part one of our icy tale. We learned how Frederick Tudor shook up the world by shipping frozen water across the globe. I had no idea about some of this history. So was he visionary or crazy, or maybe both? The next episode, we'll dive into the inevitable twilight of natural ice and the dawning of a new era, the birth of artificial ice. We'll meet a little old Apalachicola, Florida doctor who envisioned a future where ice was made, not harvested. Thanks again for listening. We've got lots more stories coming your way in season 5. Not subscribed yet? Tap the button, and until next time, stay cool out there and appreciate those ice cubes in your freezer in a whole new way.
Yo, Tudor shipped it far.